Melissa in the Morning takes a look at what the fall will bring. We're back in session now on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Well, of course, we can't do this if we don't kick things off with somebody who is very familiar to the morning show and is one of my education experts, not only in the state of Connecticut, but here on the show. And that is Fran Rabinowitz. She is the executive director of the Connecticut Association of Public School Superintendents. She has also served right here in Bridgeport. And so we welcome her back to the show, especially to talk about a topic that many of you, including myself, very worried about going into this new school year. So, Fran, welcome back. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you, Melissa. I'm looking forward to this new school year beginning.
Yeah, definitely some new beginnings and some exciting times for our kids and staff and everybody in the education sector. Fran, let's get right into this. I was reading, actually, it was on the portal.ct.gov website, that we are again seeing major teacher shortages. In fact, it looks like it's about 1,300 to 1,700 openings this year, or gaps rather. And that's actually up from last year. It was 1,200 or so that we were dealing with. And now we're looking at even more. And when you look at the list online, the majority of them are statewide. Only a few of them are Lyons districts only, which that does impact some of our school districts here in our listening area. What can you tell us? Why is the problem worse? I feel like the state has really been working to try to attract and retain teachers. Why are we in a worse position than we were last year?
Well, we have done many things as a state for the long term in terms of apprenticeship programs. And, you know, we're putting together a certification council to streamline the process without lowering standards. All of those things are wonderful things. We're putting cohorts together for paraprofessionals, et cetera, but they don't solve the issue today. And for the last 4 or 5 years, teacher prep programs have told us their numbers have dwindled. So I am not at all surprised that we have greater teacher shortages today than last year. And I think as a nation, but certainly as a state, we really have to be very aware this is not going away on its own. We've got to make some major changes in order for this to move forward. You're citing 1,300 to 1,700. Those are certified positions, but what about all the paraprofessionals as well?
So that was going to be my next question. Yep.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, the last I heard, there were at least 1,000 openings for paraprofessionals.
Oh, my gosh.
That's huge. And if we are going to have a flourishing and thriving public school system, we have got to work on this and, you know, sooner than later.
Yeah, so that was going to be my question, which was, you know, when you hear 1,300 to 1,700, who's being excluded from that? So paraprofessionals, that's been an issue for a while, and we have hundreds of openings there. What does that mean for students who need, you know, those resources? And, you know, if we have a shortage of paras, for example, or even when I'm looking at this special education, we've got a shortage statewide for pre-K through 12. What does that mean? Does that mean more kids to, you know, the staff that is already there? Like, are we looking at overload for the current paras and special educators? Or like, what happens when we have such a shortage in place?
Well, when you have a shortage like that in place, people, you know, superintendents, administrators, teachers attempt to become very, very creative in how they deliver. Let's just take special ed services, all right, and how they deliver special ed services to students. It may be in larger group settings than individually. It, by necessity, it has to become that way. We're also, I am positive of this, we are asking our special ed teachers who may have had 15 kids on their roster to now have 30 kids on their roster. And when I say that, I'm not exaggerating, Melissa. it is serious. And there are only so many things that you can do to bridge that shortage. I co-chair the statewide special ed task force, and we've been talking about it, you know, nonstop in terms of the why. Why in special ed are there so many openings? And, you know, there are many, many reasons for it. But I would say to you, if anyone hears anything today, it's that this is not going to go away on its own. This is not just a little quirk in history. This is an issue.
Mm-hmm. And of course, that issue was there before COVID. Let's make that very clear that this, this was a problem before COVID. But I think COVID exacerbated the issue, and we sort of, I don't know if we swept it under the rug, Fran, per se, but we certainly didn't address it in the here and now. Like you said, we have some long-term solutions, which we could see how that comes out in the wash later, but we don't have anything that can be put into place, it sounds like, in the next 2 weeks, let alone within this school year. Nothing that is, is making people confident.
And that is, you know, frankly, I've been saying that right along because I said that seven-year-old only has this year in first grade. What does first grade look like for that seven-year-old right now? And what is it that we could be doing right now to ensure that both short-term and long-term solutions are solid and consistent and can really make the difference that's needed?
Before you know it, we will be back in session. I'm talking about back to school time for our students here in Connecticut. And joining us to talk a little bit about teacher shortages in Connecticut is Fran Rabinowitz, the executive director of the Connecticut Association of Public School Superintendents. So before the break, Fran kind of broke down where we're seeing major shortages. In fact, we're in worse shape this year going into the school year than we were even last year. So, Fran, I think obviously we're not going to come up with solutions, at least that the state is going to implement in the next couple of weeks, I would imagine. So what do you suggest from your professional opinion? What should families be thinking about, especially if their students are in need of special educators or are in need of paraprofessionals or need to work on their sciences? It looks like bilingual teacher shortages we're having, mathematics, history, social studies, basically anywhere where they need help. What should families be thinking about right now ahead of the school year to make sure their kids are equipped properly?
So let me begin by saying, Melissa, you mentioned in the beginning that these shortages are statewide, not simply in the Alliance districts or our most challenged districts. You're 100% correct. But the impact of them statewide is not what it is in the Alliance district. So in a suburban district, there may be a shortage in special ed teachers, but it may be the fact that there's one teacher missing.
That's a good point. Okay.
That's what I'm hearing from many. Whereas in a challenge district, it is 10 times that amount.
Right.
So number one, in the suburban district, there may not be many, many repercussions. But here's the things that everyone should be aware of. Be aware that those that are working in that school district, the superintendent, administrators, teachers, are trying to do the very best they can to meet every child's needs. So let's use that as a premise. Then let's say, with that said, every parent needs to certainly be advocating for services for their child. It's incredibly important. And they have to be ensure that they are receiving the special ed services. I don't know how they will make that happen. They will do it creatively. They may outsource some of that to outside agencies to come in and service the students. It may be in a larger group, but they have to ensure that those students are receiving special ed services. The bilingual EL bothers me quite a bit more, to be honest with you, because I know that that shortage is dire, and I am not 100% sure on how they especially in your Bridgeports, are going to manage that. Nonetheless, it's important both for now and for the future that parents advocate for it. I think you can be aware that there'll be larger class sizes in many districts at the elementary level. And at the high school level, you will have teachers taking on additional assignments. So if they taught five classes, maybe now they're teaching six. That's not ideal because it doesn't give them the flexibility to meet with the students that are having difficulty, et cetera. So those are the things they need to be looking for and advocating for. And I would go so far as to say advocating with the professionals and the paraprofessionals for more help in the district, for more changes for the profession, so that we are not ending up with these shortages long term.
I'm curious, Fran, to advocate properly for yourself and for your children, do you recommend families potentially bring in an education specialist or like a liaison, like having somebody come in with you to make sure that you are advocating properly and that the school is also taking your request seriously? Like, I agree with you. I think teachers are stretched thin. I feel horrible for the situation that educators are in. But I also worry as a parent myself that you get written off if your kid, you know, is like 80% there. This isn't a huge concern. It's not visible that they need as much as you think they do. Do you recommend families bring in somebody to those meetings if they feel that they don't know how to advocate properly for themselves?
Look, Melissa, if it becomes necessary, it becomes necessary. I would think that in the beginning of your advocacy, my hope is, and my own experience, 99% of the time with my children and grandchildren, I will say I have had that need once. But for the most part, I have been able to sit down with the professionals and say, this isn't working well, or why is this the way it is? And I would ask that parents do that first. They follow the process of going in and meeting with the principal. And then if they're not satisfied there, to the next level, to the next level. I don't believe you need a child advocate or a education advocate right away. I'm the first one to say that if you do need it, get it. But don't presume that you'll need it immediately.
Well, Fran Rabinowitz, I know that we could talk about the education sector in Connecticut for days on end, but unfortunately, yes, we have run out of time for today. But I know you'll be coming back on the show very soon. Good luck. I mean, I can't believe we're in the home stretch of starting another school year. And certainly we'll see what happens down the road. But we'll see if we can find any, quicker solutions to solve this issue, maybe ahead of next year's school year. Who knows? It's a huge problem. It's been a huge problem, though.
It is. It is a problem. It's the essence of who we are. You can have great books, great materials, great technology, but you need that person mm-hmm. in the classroom who's effective and ready to go with your child. There's no more exacerbating problem that we can have than staff shortages.
Yeah, I totally agree. Fran, thank you so much. I know we're going to talk again soon, and I appreciate your time.
Okay, Melissa, anytime.
All right. Fran Rabinowitz, again, Executive Director of the Connecticut Association of Public School Superintendents, right here on WICC. But I am personally very excited to have this woman here with us today, and that is Commissioner Beth Bai. She is the commissioner for the Connecticut Office of Early Childhood. And I feel like I watched this woman, as many of you did as well, during the pandemic, as we tried to figure out how we were going to reopen schools and how we were going to handle the pandemic and everything. And I've been wanting to have her on the show. And I'm just so excited that she's coming on today and certainly talking about something that I know a lot of parents are discussing, which is the kindergarten age requirement change, which goes into effect not this school year, but next. And Commissioner Bai, she actually used to be in the Senate. She served in our Senate from 2011 to 2019, and she was in the House from 2007 to 2010. And what's amazing is she certainly has a very lengthy background in early childhood education. She has been in leadership roles for many schools in our state, and she also helped to open two early childhood magnet schools. She was the director of both the Trinity College Community Child Center and the University of St. Joseph School for Young Children, both named a State of Connecticut Model Preschool. So I think she knows a thing or two about what's going on. Commissioner Bai, I am so excited to have you on the show. How are you?
Oh, thank you, Melissa. That's quite a nice introduction. I'm really happy to be with you this morning.
I mean, it sounds probably very silly to you, but I feel like during that first few months of COVID, when, you know, everything was just kind of, we had no idea which way we were going, you were one of the common faces that I continued to see on the press conferences and somebody the governor really looked to for, you know, getting advice on the education sector of things. And so this is a real honor to have you here, and I thank you for your time.
Of course, and we were really lucky to have a governor that was focused on education and making sure kids were safe and also that families could get to work. So it was a careful line we were walking, and it really was a collaborative effort with all the commissioners and the governor, and frankly, an engaged citizenship that was letting us know what was going on.
Well, Commissioner Bai, I am very happy to have you here, especially because when the legislature wrapped up and we learned that the kindergarten age requirement was going to drastically change from January to September, there was a lot of people erupting around this because it's a huge change. And it's going to mean that there are some families now paying for an extra year of preschool or daycare. It's going to mean children's timelines of when they thought they were going to kindergarten is going to change. Talk to us, if you don't mind, from a professional standpoint about this situation, because I know there's always going to be controversy, no matter where you live, with the age requirement. And how much does it really matter how young a child is when they enter into kindergarten?
Well, it's a really good question. I think what matters is that, you know, we talk a lot about school readiness and children being ready for school. And it's also about schools being ready for children, because no matter what the date of a child's birthday, when you have a kindergarten class, there's going to be a wide range of abilities walking through that door. And so, you know, we really need to make sure our schools are ready to meet children who maybe are developmentally four and then other kids who are developmentally seven, you know, because there's just a wide range of ability in children. And some may be six socially, but when it comes to literacy, they're four, you know, so it's not like all of development is even. Some kids have really good language skills. Other kids have really good analytical skills. Some kids have it all, but there's a wide range. And I think this change, people found out about it sort of slowly because the bill didn't pass the committee, and so it didn't follow the typical pattern. And then it came back in a bill at the end on the floor and passed. And I would say Charlene Russell Tucker and I really didn't hear from people till like a month after the session ended because of the way that it happened. And then all of a sudden it was like school districts were like, whoa, there's 1 year's notice. How are we going to manage this? And parents were like, wait, I have a kid by my child enrolled in preschool this year as a 3-year-old. Does that mean they have 3 years of preschool? So, you know, anytime there's a change, there's going to be disruption. And this change, my next door neighbor have a kid whose like birthday is, you know, September 3rd.
Oh, I know. Like, yeah, I know a couple of people
What are we going to do? And he's been in preschool for a year already. So the families in these cohorts are really sort of, you know, don't exactly know what to do. So I think shows like this are super important where we can talk through some of the questions.
And I definitely want to dive more into that, which is like, what should people do? Because it does feel like a very quick turnaround that we're, I mean, luckily it's not this school year, but next year will come before you know it. And unfortunately, as you know, the state is struggling to even have enough facilities available to have reputable places, affordable places. So we're already struggling on that end anyways. So to now have a group of students who were not expected to do another year of preschool or daycare having to do that, and parents having to now budget for that extra year, definitely puts them in a little bit of a pinch. But before I get to that, Commissioner Bai, I was curious because I've lived in Connecticut almost my entire life. I was born and raised here, but I, you know, worked in news in other states. But Connecticut seems unique that our age requirement is so late. Most other states, correct me if I'm wrong, have the cutoff of September 1st. Like, are we a state that for a long time was very late in making that age requirement? Like, it seems that, I mean, January and September, those are very, very different. You're talking about half a year's difference, but a lot of other states are September 1st.
Yeah, well, we are an outlier in that way, or we have been an outlier in that way. But I think, you know, Connecticut's an outlier in education in ways that are good, in that we always have among, you know, the best schools in the country by any measure. And part of that may be because we started earlier, you know, that kids got going earlier. I don't think that's a major factor, but we have been different in education. And I know when I was in the legislature and as commissioner, I've always opposed this change only because not every child has access to preschool. We worry about the parents having to pay another year of preschool or childcare, like you said. But, you know, we estimate that there are about 3,000 children who have no early education until they reach kindergarten. So always I was saying we can make this change. We just have to make sure that everyone has access to preschool that's affordable to them before we make the change. And so, you know, I think it's incumbent upon us now over the next 12 months with working with the State Department of Ed and the Office of Early Childhood and the governor's office and the legislature to do just that, to figure out how do we make sure that families can access preschool, because we certainly don't want children entering kindergarten at almost six having had no formal early childhood experience.
That's a really good point.
So the late date for us, the late date for us has allowed those families who couldn't afford preschool to get their kids in school younger, and now that won't be true anymore.
Right. So if I'm hearing you correctly, it's not a matter of was this the right decision? It just seems like it was premature because our state, at least right now, in August of 2023, we are not equipped to offer enough daycare and preschool options for folks that either are reputable or affordable.
Yeah, I think, you know, I guess I would rephrase it a little, say, you know, it's not ideal because we don't have that. But now we are in a position, the governor has a blue ribbon panel and we're talking about this, to work with the legislature to reduce the impact of this on families who can't access preschool or childcare because it's not affordable. And, you know, Governor Lamont has increased the number of families that have access to affordable preschool. Just in the past 2 years, we have almost 5,000 more children who are receiving some child care subsidy. We've added 1,300 infant toddler spaces to help parents afford infant toddler care at those earliest stages. So we're making progress. We haven't made this much progress since the mid-90s in helping to make it affordable. So I think we can work with the legislature and make significant progress this year to reduce the impact of this.
Commissioner for the Connecticut Office of Early Childhood is here, and that is Beth Bai. We're talking about the kindergarten age requirements, the fact that it has changed from January to now a September 1st cutoff. And this has been a real eruption of conversation among parents across the state of Connecticut. So, Commissioner Bai, we were just kind of starting to get into what are the options that parents have. I know that the state is working to figure that out over the next 12 months. But what would you say to parents who are, dare I say, freaking out about this?
Yeah. Well, some of it will depend on when the child's birthday is. But the law was written in a way that if a child is not going to turn five, you know, on or before September 1st, it does allow school district to admit children who are, you know, on the cusp if they do an assessment and the child is appropriate for kindergarten. So there is that was written into the bill. It's Public Act 23208. So that's one thing parents can do if their kids are right on the cusp. But the State Department of Ed and the Office of Early Childhood are not discouraging parents. We're actually encouraging parents, you know, that they can still enroll in preschool at 2 years and 9 months, that's still a really good option, that early care and education is important for children and for families. I mean, I know as a child care teacher and director, so much of my effort was supporting parents and teaching the child, that they go hand in hand. So having your child in child care or in early care or preschool or nursery school, whatever, wherever your child's enrolled, parents also get some support about supporting their children's development and things they can do at home, et cetera. So we're not discouraging parents from enrolling their children in preschool at 2 years and 9 months, which would be, you know, the December cutoff. But that might mean a third year of preschool. So they might change the number of days per week if they're in a position where the child doesn't need 5 days a week. But so we are suggesting that. We've also really encouraged school districts to honor kids who are enrolled now. And there'll be some implications later. You know, you're going to have a whole cohort of kids that's going to be 9,000 fewer, because we expect this to impact about 9,000 students who will not have turned five by September 1st, who now can't enter kindergarten unless they get a waiver. So I think for parents, you know, families and parents are their child's very, very important teacher. And so parents will continue to support their child's development. Just when they start kindergarten will change. And for this cohort of parents whose kids were already in preschool, they're the ones who are going to have a third year, you know, for sure, because unless the child tests in, they're going to have to have their child enrolled one more year in early care. And I think for families of children with special needs, we need to work with the school districts to pay particular attention, because when children are in birth to three, which is OEC, overseas birth to three, which mm-hmm. is a early childhood intervention for children with special needs, that can be delivered at childcare, that can be delivered in the family home. It's very flexible. But when a parent of a child with special needs turns three, very often they enter a part-day public school situation that's hard for parents to manage. We know 70% of families, the only or both parents are working. And so I think for that group of families, it's going to be particularly challenging to wait a whole other year before they're in the school day, school year program that meets sort of both the educational needs of the family plus, you know, helps the family have a regular schedule where they can go to work. So I think we're going to be working with the State Department of Ed to pay particular attention to those families that have young children with special needs, because the 3 and 4 year old preschool piece is very often, if you know any families that have children with special needs, I think in the whole educational path of a family with a child with special needs, that 3 and 4 year old preschool 2 years is the hardest to manage.
The hardest. You have the, I agree.
Mm-hmm. The customized birth to three. Mm-hmm. And then once they hit school, it's school day, school year. And even with summer programming, but the preschool is challenging. So Commissioner Russell Tucker and I have been talking about looking at ways to support those families as well, and how can school districts and birth to three maybe work together and help bridge that. So we have a little bit of time to work on that, but you know, I think for that one, for those 9,000 children and their families, this 1 year notice is disruptive for sure.
Yeah. Well, Commissioner Bai, I certainly would love to have you come back on the show. We have run out of time, but again, I know not just this
anytime.
Topic. Yeah. I mean, education's so big, obviously, not just for you guys, but certainly for our listener base. And so it would be a real honor to have you come back on and talk more about these kinds of topics on the show. I would love that.
Yep. Anytime. Well, it's great to talk to you, Melissa. Thanks so much.
Yes, you too. Commissioner Beth Bai here, the commissioner for the Connecticut Office of Early Childhood, right here on WICC. We appreciate getting her comments this morning. Here in Connecticut, there are a variety of school choice options available for the hundreds of thousands of kids living in our state. And families can choose from traditional public schools, public charter schools, public magnet schools, private schools, and even homeschooling. And if you are a parent, parent looking for school choice options for your kids, you should definitely check out the Connecticut State Guide, which you can find on schoolchoiceweek.com. But what exactly is school choice, and why does it matter for families to think about that? We are talking to the National School Choice Awareness Foundation. And in fact, this morning, we have a very special guest with us, one of the spokespeople. Her name is Chrissia. Chrissia Campos-Spivey is here, and she is also the director of a project that's being done for the National School Choice Awareness Foundation, which she's also going to talk about as well. So thank you for being on the show. Chrissia, how are you?
Thank you. It's a pleasure. I'm doing well. How are you?
Yes, I'm very glad to have you here. Let's start with the very basic question of what is school choice?
Yeah, so school choice, we talk about two things. It's mostly for parents, is the ability they have to explore and choose the school type that they want their children to go to. And like you say, we're talking about traditional public school and even open enrollment. We're talking about charter school. We're talking about magnet school. We're talking about online private school and also homeschooling. So it's just that ability that parents have to explore all of these options.
Now, Chrissia, I always found school choice to be interesting because obviously for private schools, it doesn't really matter where you live in the state. You could, if you're willing to drive them or get them to the school, it's fine. Homeschooling, obviously, you do in your own home. But because of districting, I always found school choice to be interesting. Like, if you live in a certain town, what are the parameters if you wanted to go to a charter school, a magnet school, something like that? Like, does it matter where you live? Is it the same sort of parameters you have for private schools, or is it a little bit different?
Yeah, it's a very good question. We get this question a lot. So every person that we know is assigned to a particular school, but in most states, parents might not be aware that they have the option to apply to a charter school, which is a public school as well, and a magnet school, which is also a public school. So it depends on each district. Each district makes their own rules on what's available for them. Even some districts, I know Connecticut is very open with open enrollment, which means that a lot of families have the ability to go to a traditional public school that is not the one that they were particularly assigned to. And as long as there is space, and as long as there is some sort of agreement between schools and transportation, the family can choose to go to that particular school. Same thing with charter school, as long as there is some space. And it often happens with lotteries and magnet school as well. So as long as the family signs up in the right time with the lottery and all of that, they have access to these public schools, even charter and magnet school as well.
And Chrissia, really quickly, charter and magnet schools, if they are public charter, public magnet schools, is that free tuition or are you paying to go to that school like you would a private school?
No, absolutely not. Those are always public schools. Charter schools do not charge tuition, magnet schools either. They're part of the public system.
That's amazing. So, I mean, you sort of answered the question in itself, but I'll ask anyways, what is the value of parents sitting back, doing a little bit of research and seeing what their options are for their students? Like, what could a student get maybe at a charter or a magnet school that maybe they are not getting at their current public school in their district?
Yeah, when we talk about school choice, we talk about that all school types are valuable. But we also like to recognize that each child is different, and what might be good for one child might not be good for another child. I have twin boys, and I can tell you, even though they're twins, they're very, very different. They have different needs. So exploring different school choice types is super crucial for the student to find what they like to do, to explore their own abilities and to work in whatever challenges they have. So just taking that time is a very personal decision. It's a family decision. So we always encourage every parent to explore all of the school choice options. Many times they're unaware that they have more than one option in their community.
And again, we have Chrissia here, who is one of the spokespeople for the National School Choice Awareness Foundation. And we're very excited to talk about the importance of school choice. Now, is this something, Chrissia, in your professional opinion, you should really be looking at your options once kids get into middle and high school, like when they start to figure out what they want as a career? Or is it worth looking and exploring these options as young as kindergarten?
I think it's always worth exploring early in the process so you can get familiar with how everything works. Obviously, I do think it becomes more important as the child grows and they find themselves and their own abilities. We always talk about it. The perfect time to do it is in January when you have time to explore these options. But anytime is a good time to explore school choice to make sure that your child is getting the proper educational fit that they deserve.
So again, Chrissy, I'm so glad to have you here. And I was just reading actually on the schoolchoiceweek.com website, which, by the way, if you scroll to the very, very, very bottom of this website, you can put in your state and they will specifically tell you what options you have. So, for example, I went onto the Connecticut site, obviously. And when you click through, they've got different subcategories and like the public charter schools. I didn't realize this. This is pretty cool. It says charter schools, again, another free option for Connecticut families. Connecticut actually passed a charter school law in 1996. And we now have more than 20 public charter schools that parents can choose from across the state. I did not realize that. And then, of course, you've got public magnet schools as well, more options where it's free. But this, I think, is interesting because magnet schools, because I was going to ask this, the difference between charter and magnet, it seems like magnet has a more specialized focus in STEM and performing arts. Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. So public magnet schools normally are within the district. They live under the district management. And what they do is they have a theme. Very often they have art theme or sometimes a theme type of theme for the school. And that's the difference between they do that. Charter school, not necessarily. They're not necessarily in the district, but they do have this freedom to innovate and have different type of approach on education that are not necessarily theme, but they have, sometimes they are, but they're not necessarily with the district.
Chrissia Campos-Spivey is here, who is a spokesperson for the National School Choice Awareness Foundation. And we're talking all about school choice. That can be just sending your kids to a public school, private school, a public charter school, public magnet school, online schools, homeschooling, microschooling. These are all options if you look at Connecticut specifically on schoolchoiceweek.com. And really quick, Chrissia, I was curious about one quick thing. Charter schools.
Yeah.
What is the difference between just traditional public school and a public charter school? Is it uniforms?
Well, sometimes a lot of charter schools do wear uniforms, and that can be a difference. But I think the main difference between these types of schools is that charter schools have a lot more freedom to innovate in the way that they teach their children. They might choose a different curriculum and a different approach. We see some charter schools that have like a Montessori style. So you wouldn't see that in a traditional public school. But charter schools are public schools, and they do receive funds, and they can serve students, and they have that freedom that many parents might be looking for.
That's kind of, I kind of like that. That's really neat. And like you said, it's not going to be the solution for every kid. Every child is different. But I have heard a lot of parents, actually, who love the Montessori model, actually, for preschool, and probably don't realize that you can continue that on if you continue with a charter school in Connecticut. So that's really neat. I didn't know that. Chrissia, what I think is really interesting as well, I wanted to highlight, actually, you are the director of this new project, and I am not going to botch it on the air. I'm going to let you say it. But essentially, what you are doing is you are getting resources for the foundation for Hispanic families in who speak Spanish, which I think is really neat. Could you talk to us a little bit about it?
Yeah, we just learned this project. It was last year. It's called Conoce Tus Opciones Escolares. And the idea is that we believe that every parent, every family should have a lot of information and a lot of resources to make a decision about where to send their children to school. And we do not think language should be a barrier to start this journey. So we're having a lot of the resources that you see in schoolchoiceweek.com, in opcionesescolares.com. And yeah, just with the same idea to talk about all types of different school choice in every single state and to empower parents to make this decision and talk about all the different options that their children might have.
Okay, so I took Spanish for a long time and I recognize Conoce and Escolares, but how do you say it again?
Conoce tus opciones escolares.
Okay, that's the part in between that I'm talking. I can't.
It pretty much means it means know your school choice option.
Know your school choice option. Yeah, that's very, very cool. I think this is amazing. So, and this is, again, for a K through 12 system. Is this something that has already rolled out, or you're still working on this?
Excuse me?
Is this option, this project, I should say, is this available for families, Hispanic families like in Connecticut? Would they be able to utilize these resources?
Absolutely. Every family in every state could be opcionesescolares.com, and you should be able to find all the information that you're finding, that you're looking at in schoolchoiceweek.com. You will have something like that. And a little bit more addition, because we find that Hispanic families need more information about, like, for example, ELL services, or even to find out where the school that they're assigned to. So we're putting a lot of effort into that. But, yeah, it's already out in the world, and anybody can see it.
That's amazing. So, again, if you want to explore options for your children, I know we're just weeks away from the start of this school year, but it doesn't mean you can't look into options for either next school year or even to transfer during semesters. Be sure to check out schoolchoiceweek.com. And again, if you scroll to the end of that page, you will find on the homepage where you could put your state in, and then it has specifics for your state. So Connecticut has an awful lot of resources on this website. Again, schoolchoiceweek.com. And I want to thank you again, Chrystia, for coming on the show and sharing this information with us. It's really important that we find the best fit for our children and school choice. We certainly have a lot of options out there. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. A pleasure.
All right. Again, Chrystia, we thank you again for your time. Spokesperson for National School Choice Awareness Foundation here on WICC. We've been talking about the teacher shortages, not just here in Connecticut, but across the country. Going into the 2023-24 school year, we have about 1,300 to 1,700 teacher openings in our state. That doesn't even include the almost 1,000 paraprofessional openings we also have. So what is our biggest problem? Well, one of the things is attracting teachers to Connecticut, and then retaining them. What is something that would actually keep them here in Connecticut besides the job and the students and all that? It's affordable housing, which is something that, again, not just Connecticut is struggling with, but the whole country. But if we want to get great teachers to come to Connecticut and stay here, we have to give them a place to stay that is affordable. And so this initiative really caught my eye. Friends Center for Children is aspiring to provide 30% of the school's educators with free housing as a salaried benefit by the year 2023 through this groundbreaking program. In fact, this fall, two teachers and their kids are moving into new housing currently under construction, adding to the four teachers who moved into the first teaching housing properties that the school made available back in 2020. Friends Center's Teacher Housing Initiative was made possible after the school was gifted two properties, as well as refurbishing and furnishing, and this is in New Haven. So joining us to talk more about this is Alex, who is the Executive Director of Friends Center for Children. Welcome to the show. So glad to have you here.
Hi, thanks. Nice to be here.
So first of all, let's start with talking about the issues that teachers are facing with housing, whether it's here in Connecticut or just in general. Are we hitting the mark here that it's really one of the deterrents for if they're going to take a job or not, is if they can find suitable housing that's actually affordable?
Absolutely. It's about housing and it's about wages, right? So the issues that teachers are facing right now with housing in Connecticut relate to both supply, meaning is there somewhere that they can live, because we are really tight on housing, and cost. Right now, it's too expensive. There's a lack of options, and teachers are unable to find housing based on the income that they are receiving.
Specifically, Alex, can you tell us how challenging it is to place teachers and then retain them in New Haven?
Sure. So prior to the pandemic, teachers had a significantly high rate of attrition. And we're talking about, when we talk about teachers, just to level set, you know, we're talking about, infant, toddlers, preschool, and school-age teachers. Our industry, Friends Center for Children, is specifically focusing on infants and toddlers and preschoolers. So we're an early care and education program. So teachers in general are underpaid, and early care and education teachers are paid poverty level wages. So it's we are the worst of the industry, so to speak, in terms of our wage gap. So prior to the pandemic, every industry, every teaching industry had difficulty finding teachers. And in ours, we had a rate of attrition that was between 25 and 40% per year. And then obviously the pandemic hit and we were just decimated, like many industries. But unlike other industries, including teachers, we were not able to adapt. For example, we can't work from home. An infant can't use Zoom, you know, so we didn't have that opportunity. And we can't increase our wages in the way that other sectors did because we have no government or significant government or federal subsidies supporting us. Another reason we couldn't increase wages is because the cost of care is currently dictated by what parents can afford instead of what it truly costs. All this leads to low wages, and low wages leads to inability to attract talent, to attract employees, and high rates of attrition. And so Connecticut right now, like the rest of the nation, which you mentioned, you know, is having an issue from birth to, you know, all the way up to high school in terms of teacher shortages. Mm-hmm. In the early care and education field right now in Connecticut, we're short 4,400 teachers.
Wow.
And the correlation between low wages and housing is a direct line, because if you can't make a livable wage, you can't pay market rent. And we're going to continue that cycle in the early care and education system unless we have significant government investment.
Yeah, it's a real problem. And in fact, I think your initiative put out these pretty staggering numbers. It says here in Connecticut, early child care educators earn on average $16.47 per hour, according to the Center for the Study of Child Care Employment's most recent Early Childhood Workforce Index, which was only published back in 2020. It says when state by state cost of living is accounted for, Connecticut ranks 36 out of 50 states, plus the District of Columbia, where you're just, again, reiterating what you're saying. We are just not making enough money. And then that has a domino effect. You can't afford to live in the municipality that you're even serving, let alone in the surrounding community. So tell us, if you don't mind, you know, this housing initiative, why New Haven? Like, how did this all kind of come about? And tell us a little bit more about the partnership with the Yale School of Architecture.
Yeah. So we're rooted in New Haven. We're a New Haven program. I'm a third generation New Havener, raising third generation New Haven and Connecticut residents, obviously. So I love New Haven. I love Connecticut. And I think if you love something, you want it to be its best self. And the way that we treat our educators, especially our early childhood teachers, is we're not our best self yet. So at Friend Center, we really thought about how do we raise salaries? We realized that we were not going to have significant, substantial state or federal subsidies. So the question became, how do we raise teacher salaries without raising parent tuition? And this is an issue across the country. So because we had no money to raise salaries, we began to think about the concept of removing teachers' financial burdens. So we asked them, you know, what are your four biggest expenses? And at that time, we had a workforce of 29 teachers. So we surveyed them all, and only one owned their own home.
Wow.
Which really is,
that's insane.
Just that in and of itself, right, is just clearly a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And they ranged in age from 22 to 65. So we're not talking about all educators who are starting out in life.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So rent was the clear majority of the biggest expense, followed by food, transportation, and utilities. So we decided to tackle teachers' rent. We actually first partnered with the Yale School of Management Social Impact Club to really help us work through our theory, because our theory was we can buy a house and have teachers live there and really have this salaried benefit versus having to raise salaries and, you know, find the funds to raise annually at the same rate. And Yale School of Management worked with us and proved that our theory, you know, our fiscal theory works. And we got this great donation, which you mentioned, and got to purchase the first two houses and the land. And then once we had the land, we had to think about what are we going to do with this land? We don't know how to build. We don't want to be builders, and we don't have the money to do that.
Sure.
And so we were able to find the Yale School of Architecture, which has a program called the Jim Block Housing Program, where they build homes in New Haven. And what's just so remarkable about this project is that they listen to the client. And in this case, the client were the educators who were going to move into these homes. So the 69 students, you know, from Yale spent a whole semester listening, learning, and talking with these teachers. And the outcome was just this amazing house that represents their needs.
That's
the
amazing.
Other byproduct or outcome that was really remarkable was that these teachers were seen and heard and valued in ways they have that they're not by our society.
Mm.
So it was this really profound moment of transformation for the educators to really feel honored in a way that they don't on a daily basis because of the way we see them.
Right. Alex Schiavone is here, and she is the executive director of Friends Center for Children. We're talking about an initiative that is placing early childhood educators in free housing. And I wanted to talk first, before we talk about how teachers get chosen for this, Alex, because I would imagine there's a huge demand for it. Can you tell us, kind of give us a snapshot of like the salary savings because of what your program is doing for teachers by giving them this housing?
Sure. So an individual, so for the teacher, the individual benefit salary jump can go from $34,500, which is our Connecticut average for early care and education teachers. And just as an FYI, that includes about 70% of us have degrees. So we have a really low average in our state. And the sort of fair market rent averages are around $20,000 in this state. So if we look at the initiative, we can go from $34,500 to $54,500 for the educators.
Wow.
So we're talking about a significant increase. And as you, the one of the really positive aspects of this initiative is that it's not, we don't have to supply that influx of cash on an annual basis. So it's a one-time cost. So for example, we can purchase a home, and a three-family home in New Haven is around $400,000 right now. And then the combined rent for the three teachers who live in those places is obviously $20,000 each. So you're looking at $60,000 in terms of salary increase for the teachers and a salary savings for the organization. So really just a great opportunity to increase salaries, almost double them in some cases, depending on the size of the unit and where your market is.
Good grief.
So that's really what's exciting about it. And when we're done with our expansion, we will 30% of our teachers will have an salary savings of $500,000 a year. So $500,000 a year.
That's unbelievable. But with that, Alex, I would imagine you have a wait list that is probably all the way from Connecticut down to Texas. I would imagine so many people want to get in on this. How do you choose which teachers get the housing?
Yeah, so to be fair, we actually have not advertised it a lot because we don't have enough stock yet to be able to meet everybody's needs. So for existing teachers, we have some eligibility requirements. You have to be an existing Friends Center employee in good standing. And then we have looked at it from an income eligibility space and based on life stage. So an annual salary of, $38,500 or less for a single adult, $64,000 or less for an adult with child, and then $79,000 or less for two adults with a child or children. So we really look at it as an equity initiative. And the ultimate goal of the housing program, while increasing salary, is to we pair them with a fiscal coach so that they can have goals. So whatever those fiscal goals are, whether it's buying a car, paying off debt, and eventually buying a home. So the goal is to get them to out of our housing and into their own home when they move out of our space.
That's amazing. And I know if I could just pick your brain for another hour, I would. But my final question, I think, is kind of what is the end goal for you guys? How many teachers do you plan to house? And on average, how long do they stay in this housing?
Yeah, so we really want to have 30% of our workforce. We're estimating that right now on 80 teachers in our workforce when we're done with our growth plan. So that's about 24 units. So that's our internal goal. And our external goal is really to share this and to show both state and federal decision makers that this is a real operable solution to a crisis that we're facing in our state and in our country.
Yeah, I hope they see it. I hope they hear this story because it really is quite profound and it's a real game changer for educators here in Connecticut. Alex, do you mind? Do you have a website or anything if people want to learn more?
Yeah, we're at friendcenterforchildren.org. So four words, friendcenterforchildren.org.
All right. And Alex, I want to thank you so much and for your team and what you're doing and seeing the need and filling that need, one housing unit at a time. We really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks, Laura. Really nice to be here with you.
Yeah, it was great to have you here. Again, the website is friendscenterforchildren.org. It's all spelled out, friendscenterforchildren.org. And Alex Schiavone, again, such a pleasure to have you on the show, the executive director of Friends Center for Children here on WICC. Let's talk about safety and security. And this kind of prompted from the news we talked about earlier this week, when we heard of a third intruder situation for a Yale University college student. This was off-campus housing where someone woke up to an intruder in their home. This is the third time, actually, in just months that this has gone on for Yale University. But we do know that the threat is very much alive and well in the news, unfortunately, at college campuses across the country. And it sort of also sparked my interest to just talk about safety in general, even for the younger kiddos who walk to school, bike to school, get off the bus, and they are approached by a stranger. So we have Gary McNamara back on the show with us. Not only is he the former chief of police in Fairfield, but he is currently the chief and executive director of public safety and government affairs at Sacred Heart University. Pretty fitting for what we're talking about. So, Gary, welcome back to the show. How are you?
I am well, Melissa. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. This news, especially out of New Haven, has really shaken up a lot of, especially students, but their families, certainly. What are some things that are in place, like for Sacred Heart, for example? What are some things you guys talk about on and off campus for students to make sure that they are as safe as possible?
Well, first of all, we don't take the summer off, obviously. You know, safety, we're always looking at not only what we're doing during the summer, but, you know, what the fall is going to look like. And in addition to that, all the universities, public safety, we talk and we communicate, we meet regularly. So we have some of these discussions. So we're certainly in communication to learn what's going on there. But, you know, when you start talking about off-campus housing, that's really the moment in time where people transition from, you know, people think going to college is when, you know, you're on your own. You know, if you're living in a residential campus housing, you know, you're still kind of in a protective bubble. It's really when you start to go out on your own. It's mm-hmm. like you're living in your own residence. And that's the time when you really have to hone in that you're basically own your own house now. So the security that we all practice in our daily lives and at home, they kind of have to get that mentality as well.
That is a really interesting way of saying it, Gary. I don't think that ever really clicked with me before until you just said that. I didn't think about the fact that what we do in our homes, so the things that we warn people about, you know that your driveway doesn't mean no one's going to come up it, so make sure you are putting your car in a secure place, or and if you're not, make sure you're locking it, take your valuables out. I can remember distinctively having friends who lived off campus in college, and I mean, that just was not, that was not the mentality we had. And I think it's because you, again, even though you live off campus, you still feel like you live in a college bubble a little bit. Like, no one's going to bother us. But that's clearly not the case.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. And you're transitioning with a bunch of friends. So it's like last year we were in a dorm or res hall. Now we're living in a house around the corner. So that's the first message we have to get to our students. We have to say that, you know, in addition to that, they're going to a rental property in most cases. So they have to understand what the security measures are there. Do they have cameras? Do the locks work? They really have to work on not only signing the lease and planning what they're going to do during school and off hours. They really have to go through what those security measures are and work really in conjunction with us and the police department in the area. In our case, you know, Bridgeport and Fairfield, you know, I just met with parents who are transferring. The students are transferring. So yesterday we had a conversation with some of the parents, and we talked about a little bit about that. Hmm. So we're coordinating with Bridgeport and Fairfield chiefs to kind of get them to come on campus and talk to students that live off campus on some of the things that they should be aware of. We really need that communication with local public safety partners, law enforcement, and the students themselves to really understand that they play a key role in, you know, those observation skills, all the things that we talk about on a daily basis that we all do. We need to make sure that the students do that as well.
Yeah. And another thing, Gary, I was wondering, because a lot of times, obviously, again, it's a mentality thing. It'll be students who are like, oh, I want to leave the door unlocked because if my friends want to pop by and I'm napping or something, that's fine. They could just come in. Do you suggest, though, because I was thinking about this, especially with rental properties, or if you've got a place where, let's say, like it's known as a place that seniors usually move into, but then they're going to move out at the end of the school year and the next senior class will kind of go in. Do you suggest changing the locks every school year so that past people who may have copies to that key can't get in? Or is that not really a concern?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, maybe that it might be a good idea. I never really thought much about that. You know, certainly, generally what we're seeing, first of all, we don't know whether these cases in New Haven are targeting college students. You know, there's house break-ins overnight all the time. Well, not all the time, but there are house break-ins. The reason they're getting the attention is because they're happening in college, off-campus college housing. Mm-hmm. So we don't know whether the intruders are actually targeting college students. I mean, it doesn't make a difference, but, well, it does in a way, because you're targeting those houses that are with college students. But, you know, look, I think that the landlords, that's a discussion that the students should have with landlords.
Yeah, certainly. And Gary, I mean, it's hard to bypass one of probably the most horrific stories that happened earlier this year, which were the brutal murders of four students in Idaho because somebody was able to get into the home. Do you suggest, you know, again, I think the biggest takeaway from that story is, you know, especially if you're going to be intoxicated, not that I'm getting to that, but if you're going to be intoxicated, because that is literally inevitable with being in your college years, drinking or drugging or whatever, how prevalent is it that maybe somebody in the home is at least like almost like when you have a designated driver, but having like a designated sober person in the home? Like, I don't know if that's a discussion that people should be having as well. But that seems to be kind of a vulnerable spot, is if you just kind of leave your house open, you're having house parties, or you regularly have people you don't even recognize coming in. Should there be somebody like designated as your like DD or your, what would it be, your designated house watcher? I don't know.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, I always compare it to if you have a party at your house. You don't, you know, there's always somebody responsible there. You know, if I'm having people over, I don't kind of necessarily get to the point where I don't comprehend what's going on. You know, I want to make sure that my house is okay, everybody's having a good time. And I think that transitions to them as well. They don't oftentimes think that way, but we really have to encourage them to think that way. There always has to be a responsible person. And it really comes down to having some responsibility. So to make sure that you're going to have a party. And we always encourage that when I was still chief and we were dealing with some of the off-campus housing parties, is to make sure that there's somebody that's responsible for noise complaints or something. We can call them and say, turn the music down or whatever situation erupts. But yeah, safety is a big thing. And that's the thing. Students don't think that way because they've already gone to college. They don't realize that they're actually now not really under the auspices of the college bubble. And that is really the biggest message and the biggest thing that we have to hone into college students. You are no longer under our protective web. We still have a responsibility to help you if we can. We always tell our students in the north end of Bridgeport, if they call the police, call us too. You know, if we're available, we'll come by.
We'll come get you. Yeah.
Yeah, we always have to kind of make sure that we don't forget them, but they are transitioning to being off campus, almost commuter students in a way.
Yeah. We're chatting with Gary McNamara, the Chief and Executive Director of Public Safety and Government Affairs at Sacred Heart University. We were just talking about especially off-campus housing and the mindset that college students should have to stay safe during the upcoming school year. But Gary, I wanted to talk about the younger students, the K-12 students who walk to school, bike to school, get off the bus and have a little bit of ways to go until they get to their home. What can you tell parents? I think one of the biggest fears, unfortunately, in today's world is that they will be approached by somebody, whether that is a kidnapping situation, whether it's a sex trafficking, human trafficking situation, or just a creep. What should parents be talking to their kids about or having them be on the lookout for?
First of all, I'm so glad we're talking about it because it's so important and parents don't really think about it. Best advice, parents need to be proactive. They really need to be proactive. So what does that mean? You know, walk the route with your student beforehand. Drive the route And all along the way, you know, we always fall back on this stranger danger concept that if somebody approaches you and they're a stranger, do this. And, you know, we've had discussions with parents over the years and they raise their hands and they're proud that they talk about it, which is good. The problem is the stranger should never get that close to have that discussion. It shouldn't even happen. Mm-hmm. It's never appropriate for an adult to approach a child. There's no reason for it.
Right.
So walk it with the child and then say along the way, if a car stops, what would you do? What would you do here? Where would you run to? There's a house here. What would you do to kind of be proactive to put it in the student's mind that, you know, what would they do if? Really, that's what it comes down to. We've talked about it before. Law enforcement does it all the time. What if? We need to do that with our students, and parents need to kind of be really proactive in that approach.
I know it's always ideal, Gary, that you've got your student walking with a friend or with an older sibling or something, but not everybody is that lucky. I know plenty of people who their kids are walking to school or they are walking home by themselves, even if it's just a block. Obviously, if you can find a buddy, that's ideal. But what would you suggest for the people who cannot find that buddy for their kids? Do you have any suggestions for them?
Well, I think the point would be that's why it's so critical to walk with the student and talk about it during this time when you're alone. Maybe it's a bus stop and then you're alone for a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the time to be on your phone. That's not the time to have something in your ears.
That's a good point.
It's really that alert moment. You know, students are not going to be alert the entire time. None of us are. So you have those alert spaces, those times when you need your child to understand that this is the moment in time you need to be alert for anything that might occur. Obviously, you don't want to scare them,
right?
But you want to understand the importance of it, to say, what would you do if during this period of time a skunk came out of the woods? That's a real easy one, especially for a student. We talk about that with teachers about
I like that approach. That's a great
kids.
Approach.
You know, you don't talk to your kids about your young children about lockdown drills, what you would do. We try to encourage them to talk about if there's a skunk in the hallway, what would you do? Because it makes very easy sense to students. So what would you do if a skunk came out of the woods at this moment? What would you do? Where would you go? And they're not going to stay around. You don't have to talk about the creep or the bad person. It's really what would you do in those particular moments. You have to make it simple for them to understand. And then the other thing is, Melissa, I've always talked to my kids' bus drivers at the beginning of the school year, introduce mm-hmm. myself, and because it's important to kind of have that relationship with bus drivers as well.
Mm. Well, yeah, and I mean, especially we are still dealing with a bus driver shortage. It's in our news today that we still have bus driver shortages, and so they're really strapped. Unfortunately, we have had routes interrupted. We've had kids dropped off at the wrong places. Again, I'm not totally, you know, blaming the bus drivers. I think we're very strapped in Connecticut and across the nation. So it is very important you make that connection with the bus drivers. That's a really good point. And I even love, Gary, the idea of like what you're talking about, which is just having these constant conversations and reminding them to not be distracted. I can't tell you how many times I will see even high schoolers who have the earbuds in, and you know that they can't hear anything. Like, they can't hear if you're beeping your horn. I've literally driven up, like, in Fairfield, you know what, right near Ward. I drive up that area all the time. I'm trying, like, right near Tunxus Hill, I'll drive up that area, and everyone's got the earbuds in, and I'll see them wander, like, literally into the street and not realize that they're, like, texting and walking. I sound like a grandma, but I'm like, please don't text and walk, because they can't hear me. I'm kind of beeping, and I'm like, you're walking in the street. Like, what are you? But yeah, I think that conversation has to happen too. Like, the earbuds cannot go in, honestly. Even the texting, it's like, okay, at least you could look up quickly. But if you can't hear anything, somebody could come up behind you easily. I mean, you're a target.
Yeah,
you're a walking target.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And the other thing is, encourage students to kind of play those social interaction games. So be on the phone, even if you're not on the phone.
Right.
Put so that if somebody's driving by, it's more likely they're going to drive by and pass by you if they're looking to do
harm. Well, because now you've got a witness, technically. Right.
Exactly.
You've got somebody who's going to know.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah.
But you have to have those discussions along the way, because otherwise people really don't generally think that way, and kids don't think that way.
No.
You know, some do, but you really, those kind of things really matter. Again, be proactive. You have to make sure that it's not only getting them to the bus, but it's not only the safety at school. We always talk about that in depth. it's really getting them from your house to school and back safely that really is sometimes overlooked, especially, like you said, for those walkers.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Gary, I think that this is all very important information right before we head into a brand new school year. I certainly wish every single student the utmost safety and security and that they start things off on a great foot. And I thank you for making that happen with all these great tips. Thank you.
All right, Melissa, thanks as always, and be well, and we will talk soon.
Yes, yes, we will. Gary McNamara, Chief and Executive Director of Public Safety and Government Affairs at Sacred Heart University, right here on WICC.